This is part two. We're with JQ, and again, the series is entitled Poetic Perplexities, Emerging Vision of Global Empire Visions. And you've heard part one just before, obviously, folks, but before we go into any deeper into the Anarchiad, I don't want to tease it any longer, but it did occur to JQ that he'd like to address something that goes back to the keeper of lists, Jedediah Morse. So by all means, JQ, take it away.
Absolutely. What we had been talking about was the point was that seeing Jedediah Morse as someone coming from the so-called Federalist side of the fence, if you will, might intuitively to those of us who are looking into this side of history seem an unlikely figure to be raising this type of conspiracy theory, quote-unquote, concerning the Illuminati. But that took me, later in the intervening couple of weeks here, it took me back a little bit to a good number of years ago to when I had first become aware of quote-unquote conspiracy theories, and I don't remember if it was during, you know, undergraduate or grad school. In some of my spare time, I would kind of nose around the stacks of the university library looking for some of these old books about this kind of subject matter. And there's something really curious that I stumbled over that I really wish I could get my hands on again. And I don't think I even saw it in the online catalog or anything like that at the time. I was kind of, I was looking for, I believe, one of Nesta Webster's books.
Oh, yeah.
And I was kind of just browsing the shelves and the stacks, and I came upon this old book that looked like it had been, you know, very custom-bound and almost self-published in a way. And the author was somebody, a woman of at least lower nobility origin, and this was published around, I only have a rough window, somewhere in the late 19th century or very early 20th, you know, let's say 1880 to 1900, somewhere in that vein. And she had a title. She was a countess or something. And the book was written in English, but I don't think she was British. It might have been in Germany or Austria or someplace like that. But she wrote this lengthy scholarly tome about these subversive movements and secret societies that were, in her view, afflicting Europe and were responsible for the French Revolution and were really going after the royal families, of which she was at least a small part. And so it was a really thorough book. I mean, she had a chapter on the Freemasons, a chapter on the Bavarian Illuminati, the chapter on the Theosophical Society. And her thesis there was that, you know, be aware of what you're seeing in terms of these popular revolutions happening that have happened in France and elsewhere. They're, you know, the product of these nefarious secret societies who want to bring down our current form of government, transform society, and get rid of all of our religion and traditional morality. So at that time, having seen that, my sort of pet theory was that these narratives, although of conspiracy, they may not have been originated in this way, that they were perhaps being promulgated in some way or another by the members of these noble classes in order, as sort of a fear-mongering or scare tactic, to try to divert people from these supposedly popular revolutions.
Well, let me ask you something, because you're driving me wild. I have come across this book, but I cannot recall the title. Can you share that title with us?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's what's frustrating me, because, you know, I'm a state away from where I was at the time, so I'm hoping I can get back down to that that graduate library there and see if I can find it again, because I've done all kinds of keyword searches and so forth in their online catalog, so the name is just escaping me. The closest I can come, it's a female author, and I think her noble title was a countess. She was a European countess, and she wrote it in English, and it seemed like it was a very custom published sort of thing, not like a major publishing house. Is it ringing a bell for you? Is it something you might
absolutely
have run across before?
Yes, and it's good to just mention it, because people will hear this and they will come across it, but there is no doubt and I can see it in my mind. I've either had the book, and I'm even thinking it may be accessible, because one of the good things that's going on right now, and we talked about this with Theo and also Eric the Blacksmith, one of the things I'm astounded about is that there are more and more suppressed books, or what we would call suppressed books, that are popping up on the Internet, and especially at this one site, archive.org.
Absolutely.
And Theo went nuts about this one book, and, I mean, he doesn't really get, you know, that effusive about this kind of thing. And he was like, man, this is like 100 pages, chock full with meat, no fat, no bloviating. And he goes, the name of the book is Behind the Dictators. And somebody else at the same time told me that they got hit between the eyes with it. This is just kind of like serendipity. I go on archive.org because Theo had to buy his, and there it is. And I'm like, whoa. So, yeah.
That's amazing.
That's floating around somewhere, and all the sleuths will get to it. So thank you for teasing us.
Yeah, now this one, I think, goes, yeah, they'll find it, I hope. This one goes a good deal further back than what you're talking about there. I think I would guesstimate that it's around 400 pages or so, and almost obsessively researched. So this is clearly someone who had a lot of time on her hands. Before I lose the point, though, the tie back to Morse, to make it clear, was that if you posit that the people who set up the federalized regime after the Articles of Confederation period were arguably the most elite classes in the new republic, and arguably also had more ties, either money wise or relationships or whatever, back to the more noble and monarchical classes in Europe. I mean, that's the argument that's made sometimes. So if you look at it from that perspective of this woman being part of nobility, putting out these theories about the secret societies, and then if you look at the people who set up the centralized regime here in the U.S. as being more aligned, I mean, the phrase was used, elected monarch, for example, by the anti-federalists, and I think there's a lot of, there's something really that needs looking at is in terms of that choice of words. So if you see somebody setting up a quasi-monarchical regime or supporting that kind of regime, and then they're using a conspiracy, and then you look back at the royal families in Europe and people of that ilk postulating the same things about secret societies, then that's a bit of an eye-opener.
Going back to Jedediah Morse, have you had a different thought perhaps, or changed any of your attitudes as to his validity or how serious this matter might have been?
You know, I really can't say anything conclusive about it. I know that there were others in that era, especially in New England, who were kind of railing about the dangers of these secret societies, but in terms of the reality of it, was it fear-mongering? Was there some sort of manipulation taking place? I couldn't answer that right now. I know in that one excerpt, I'd have to look further back in my talking points here, but he quotes, the professor he quotes of being one of his sources of information is someone who wrote one of the more well-known books on secret society, Professor Robison, actually.
Right.
Yeah, and I've stumbled across his, I haven't read his books, but I've stumbled across it in catalogs of more places that sell these more arcane books and things like that. But whether there was any kind of manipulation or machinations behind where those ideas were coming from, I couldn't answer at this point.
I think if it serves any purpose or a major purpose, I think you have to take him seriously enough to understand that a lot of the things he does mention were going on. I mean, you had intrigues in France right after the American Revolution. And remember, the United States also was populated. I mean, it reminds me of the California of the 18th century, because it was a place where a lot of sects, S-E-C-T-S. All right, Timmy.
You're right.
I'm sorry, she's going crazy right now.
Oh.
No, where a lot of cults, sects, whatever you want to say, came to this country. I mean, you know, everybody gets into this, like, melting pot thing. Well, okay, if that ever really happened, then you have to understand it has a beginning, and there are fragments of other societies and other countries that are trying to get together. I mean, you have the Puritans, you had the Pilgrims before that, you've got Quakers coming here. And I mean, Pennsylvania alone, people would be surprised to find how many movements, if you will, house themselves in Pennsylvania. So, I mean, there was a lot going on, and as you had come across not too long ago, you got hit between the eyes by the fact that there was an anti-Masonic move. You know, like, what's that all about?
Right,
so
right.
There certainly was concern about these things. And, of course, Jedediah did not mention it. You know that Samuel did. And that is also, you've got perhaps the Illuminati still trying to run around. You've got the Jesuits that nobody wants to talk about. So there's a lot of things going on. And perhaps, if I remember correctly, there was a, I guess, an extension to certain power parties in Europe by the Rothschilds. Hey, why don't we just make Europe basically a European Union? Why don't we make this kind of one world thing? And not everybody signed on to it. So, there again, I don't think that that is an incorrect story. I don't think it's apocryphal at all. So, I mean, we have to realize, in the West at least, there's a lot of stuff going on. That was a crazy period going out of the 18th into the 19th century.
Absolutely.
So, anyway, Jedediah at least raised a flag that said, you know, there's some intrigues here, folks. You might want to look into it. And, of course, he was pretty much lambasted for it. So that either makes him really right or really crazy, or maybe both. So.
Exactly. Yeah, hard to explain at this point. But he doesn't seem like, you know, what you would call a raving lunatic, because he seems to have plenty of marbles. So whether it was some sort of delusion or something really to be concerned about, or just plain fear-mongering, I think that's left to further research to decide.
But it's good to point out at least, let's, you know, because it's left out of the history texts, and that is we were not sovereign right out of the chute, and some would argue that we never were and never have been. And so certainly there's a time when I think probably a lot of people who wanted to see this as experiment called the United States work, that they were really very sensitive to what they considered possible threats to that.
Exactly. But it's just interesting to see that kind of concern coming from the side that are really seem to be in favor of setting up a new centralized regime.
Yes.
Rather than seeing what this liberty thing is under the more loosely confederated states. But that actually, I think that makes a bit of a good transition into the Anarchia, because we might see,
right,
not so much talk about secret societies necessarily, but certainly things that you could on some level call fear-mongering. So if you think this is an opportune moment, we can transition right into the first excerpt.
Well, you did that smoothly, so I'm not going to ruin it.
All right, well, great. So I'm starting here from pages 6 and 7, and these are, I believe, the first opening lines of verse after the prose introductions that the authors provide in various interludes. So without further ado, we'll start off with, in visions fair the scenes of fate unroil, and Massachusetts opens up my soul. There chaos, anarch old, asserts its sway, and mobs and myriads blacken all the way. See day's stern port behold the martial frame of Shays and Shattuck's mob-compelling name. See the bold Hampshireites on Springfield pour. The fierce Tauntonians crowd the alewife shore. O'er Concord fields the bands of discord spread, and Worcester trembles at their thundering tread. See from the proud Egremont the woodchuck train sweep their dark files and shade with rags the plain. Lo, the court falls, the affrighted judges run, clerks, lawyers, sheriffs, every mother's son, the stocks, the gallows, loose the expected prize, see the jails open and the thieves arise. Thy constitution, chaos, is restored. Law sinks before thy uncreating word, and thy hand unbars the fathomed gulf of fate, and deep in darkness whelms the newborn state. So that's the end of that first excerpt there. Any thoughts about that? I think there's a lot of loaded phrasing in there to scrutinize.
as Soupy Sales would say. What do we mean by that?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Please tell me you're not too young for Soupy Sales.
I've certainly heard talk of him. I don't think I have firsthand memories of him, though.
How else can you bring Soupy Sales into something that's back in the 19th century? No, this is referring to Shay's Rebellion, I think,
right,
specifically. And you had mentioned a name that isn't really associated with Shay's Rebellion, and you know, Lord knows, few people even are aware of that, and that is Day, Luke Day. And
right,
really, everybody, the historians that get deep into this think that it really should have been called Day's Rebellion, but it was Shay's, and here you've got all the players named in this particular passage. What I'm thinking about is that these guys, they were Yalies, right?
Yes.
And Yalies we consider elites. And even Jedediah
right,
Morse you could consider an elite. And that means, okay, do they really have the same thing at heart as the hoi polloi in all the states? I'm thinking probably not. Now, that doesn't make them wrong. But they make this Shay's Rebellion now turn out to be just a bunch of hoodlums who were turning things upside down. I mean, is that the tone that you got from this?
Yeah, absolutely. And I was, you know, looking at it from a more general big picture sense, in the sense that, well, we've just won this so-called revolution. We have all this liberty. We better clamp things down before people really start running amok all over the place. And it's just, you know, you see the same tune playing over and over again right up to today, I think. It's just, you know, fear of,
yep,
of anarchy is a motivation for supporting the security of a strong federal government, and we've got to clamp down on this liberty. Too much liberty isn't necessarily a good thing, and you're going to have mobs and lawlessness and insurgents and chaos are going to be the result if we don't restore law and order.
Well, can you not see this being played out now in this particular scenario? You could have had CNN read that, referring to those crazy conspiracy theorists and tinfoil hat wearers and militia. Because when you get into a battle between two ideologies, I mean, if somebody's got the bully pulpit, apparently like these gentlemen did, I mean, you don't deal in tones. You deal in black and white. So you go to the extremes. They're all crazy. We're really right on. You know what I mean? There's nothing in between. And here they're making them all sound like hooligans, and we would be obviously naive to think that there weren't hooligans involved in this. I mean, no doubt, or some people were just going off and becoming brigands on their own. But they paint everybody, again, with the same stroke, and these guys are all crazy. And, I mean, they really shook up some people. They went after the right parties, the sheriff, and then they went after the judges. So...
Yeah. And I think you're right about the hooliganism. I mean, I think you have to think back under the conditions that, especially among the so-called hoi polloi, that, you know, everyday people had to deal with. I think, you know, the struggle for survival for the common man was probably a lot more, well, was certainly a lot more intense than it is today. So I think the kind of rough and tumble, you know, rugged individualism could certainly contribute to an element of that, but whether it was the kind of threat that these fellows from Yale are trying to play it out as is another question, or is it just, you know, taking advantage of a certain situation, or if there's an element of agent provocateurism built into it, I mean that's something to scrutinize, but they're clearly latching on to what's happening here as a opportunity, for lack of a better word, to say that, look, you know, chaos is about to break out if we don't do something here. Thy constitution, chaos,
yeah,
is restored. I think that's a really telling phrase there.
Your constitution is chaos, absolutely.
Right.
Would it be all right with you if I put up a link that seems to be a pretty middle-of-the-road explanation of Shay's Rebellion?
I think that would be great to shed some additional light on that, particularly because that's a topic there that I haven't studied up on a great deal. except knowing the general idea that there were these kinds of uprisings taking place in that era right after the revolution.
I won't go any further into it. I'll just state this, that this comes from Springfield Technical Community College. And Springfield was right in the middle of all this. I mean, Springfield's kind of in the western part, maybe west, south and west. So Shays Rebellion home was Massachusetts. But a lot of these farmers who had been in the service were getting higher taxes, but weren't able to get their farms back up and running to where they were before they went ahead and served their, I guess, new country. And basically, they were getting pissed off. And, you know, it's the old story is you can overthrow a government as long as you got the same weapons they do. And at this time, you know, you can be sure that the populace had the power to overthrow what they considered. And, of course, you just got out of a revolution. So these guys have to be thinking, man, we just did this to throw off the yoke of oppression. And here we are fighting our own people. So that's what it was, a farmer's rebellion. And it's really forgotten about. And, of course, later on, you have the Whiskey Rebellion out in Pennsylvania when Boy George went ahead and called the troops out on them. So, I mean, what a scenario in the United States that after you throw off Britain, supposedly, now you're fighting your own. You know, you know, same old, but, you know, just different people.
Yeah. I mean, I'd have to delve deeper in terms of you know, having any clear insights or theories about it, but it does make you wonder as to whether where the organization and resources behind, you know, popular quote-unquote rebellions like that were coming from. I mean, it brings to mind a quote from Oswald Spengler that I ran across when I was reading the classic Gary Allen book for the first time, None Dare Call It Conspiracy, which I first read. And the Spengler quote there, which really was an eye-opener to me because, you know, he wasn't talking about, you know, the Rothschilds per se or anything like that, but he was asserting that there, I'm paraphrasing here obviously, but there has never been any rebellion, whether socialist or proletarian, that has not had money at the core. And that got me thinking that, well, you know, really, do we really think that angry serfs with pitchforks are just suddenly spontaneously and organically got together and overthrew the Tsar in 1917? I don't think so. You know, there was organization coming from someplace, and usually people who are part of the so-called proletariat are too busy scratching out their daily existence to be able to think about organizing at that kind of level.
Now you got me wondering. Well, who was the money behind this, or was it the fact that they were so localized that in a guerrilla type of sense, if you will, they didn't need that much? They had the support, obviously, of the land, and guerrilla groups are sometimes hard for standing armies to fight. It's either that.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. No, it just has me wondering, was there some money behind it? There could have been some groups elsewhere even outside the states, I mean, in the frontier, which we now know is Ohio, who might have been supporting them. In fact, I think there was one group called the Society of Cincinnati. So that might be it. But, I mean, your point's well taken, and the Spengler quote is very salient, because you ain't fighting without the do-re-mi.
That's true. And we have to remember that we're talking about a time, even, you know, 60, 70 years later, that any average Tom, Dick, or Harry could walk up to the White House and ask to speak to the president and possibly get an audience with him. So if you're talking about local authority, you know, the town hall or something, it doesn't sound so infeasible for farmers to raid the town hall or whatever and make an impact on government. So you have to look at it from that perspective as well. But again, I think the issue of where the organization and resources are coming from is still, you know, worth scrutinizing.
We don't have much left in that particular piece. You didn't finish it the whole way through, did you?
Well, I had kind of a break in the excerpts, but I think this is, I didn't mark a page number here for the next line, but it's, this is book 23 on page 16, and I did have that marked. we see another familiar theme, which will be apparent, I think, as we get into this excerpt, so I'll get right into it. It's, "Bow low, ye heavens, and all ye lands. Draw near, the voice prophetic of great anarch here, from eastern climes by light and order driven. To me, by fate, this western world was given. My standard reared, the realm imperial rules, the last asylum for my knaves and fools. Here shall my best and brightest empire rise, wild riot reign and discord greet the skies. Awake, my chosen sons and folly brave, stab independence, dance o'er freedom's grave. Sing choral songs while the conquering mobs advance, and blot the debts to Holland, Spain, and France, till ruin come with fire and sword and blood, and men shall ask where your republic stood. Thrice happy race, blessed are discord's heirs, blessed while they know what anarchy is theirs, blessed while they feel to them alone 'tis given to know no sovereign, neither law nor heaven. From all mankind by traits peculiar known, by frauds and lies distinguished from mine own, wonder of worlds, like whom to mortal eyes none e'er have risen and none e'er shall arise."
I got one question.
Okay.
And it's not a big deal, but it struck me because I was trying to figure it out, and then the time I devoted to it, I don't know what he was referring to, and I know you may not either when he says, "thrice happy race." Three times.
Yeah, that is interesting. Yeah, that's quite a phrase there,
yeah.
And that warrants explication. How blessed are discord's heirs? So I guess that's the reference to thrice happy race, because, again, this is being written from the point of view of either, you know, the god anarch itself or somebody speaking from that point of view. So I guess the heirs of discord are the thrice happy race. So that's a great question. Is he looking back at three historical epochs where anarchy may have reigned?
Yeah, and the other thing that's tied into, which I think is a very good historical nugget, and what was stated there about sing choral songs while conquering mobs advance and blot the debts to Holland, Spain, and France. Now, I don't know if that's a thrice happy race also, but or a referral to what they're saying there, and I guess that's what, expunging the debts, don't pay Holland, don't pay Spain, don't pay France.
Right, or that's what the spirit of anarchy wants to do, is to just repudiate that debt. And I think the pretty clear implication from the Woods here is that, you know, well, we can't repudiate that debt. That would be, and I think even George Washington was saying, you know, that would be the immoral thing to do. We do owe this debt legitimately, and if we don't, they're going to come and get us and claim what is theirs.
But right there, it shows you. I mean, we haven't together talked about this thing, but I don't think you don't agree. And that is, people forget there are entangling, I won't say alliances, but there are certainly entangling ligaments between this new country and Europe. I mean, I'm sure Spain had ideas. I'm sure, well, Holland I can only see as a, you know, let's face it, a fading military republic, if it ever really was. I mean, how well can you fight when you're below sea level? No, I'm sorry. But, I mean,
right.
With Germany also, and how fragmented it was. So, I mean, there's a lot of countries perhaps that had, you know, ideas either for our benefit or not. And, of course, England doesn't want anybody horning in on this because, for the most part, you know, they funded everything in the very beginning. And they want their money. So, you know, we forget about the monetary element that's brought out here. And we don't get that in our history books. But, again, this is a fragile republic right now. And, you know, it could teeter and be kicked off. So I just think that this is good that it reminds people that the United States was pretty much in an incubator through this period and was really very susceptible to a collapse.
Yeah, I think that's legitimately true, and that if you look beyond, it's not just political alliances, but monetary alliances, and that again makes me think of some of the work you did with The Informer, and I guess Montgomery, But, I mean, they're referring to Holland, Spain, and France, but is it really the governments or the official governments, quote-unquote, of those countries, or is it more about the joint stock companies who were the investors in this colonial venture? And although you could say, you know, Holland, okay, a fading military power, but what about a financial power? That could be quite another question. And I think it would just be, and maybe somebody like the informer or Montgomery has done this, and I haven't looked into it enough, but just to trace the whole succession of those foreign debts, I mean, it would be really interesting to see if we find a heritage of foreign debt back to the origin of this country that has persisted somewhere or another through succeeding interests through all these intervening 200-some-odd years, that would be very telling.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking, and I won't take up any more of your time, because I think you're going to come upon it. These individuals also who wrote the foursome who wrote the Anarchiad or contributed to it also take a slap. And this also happened in and around Massachusetts as well. Take a slap at what looked like a successful small banking system that was working, but again, this didn't play into the idea of Hamilton's central bank, which these characters also didn't want, these new citizens of the United States. And I think you're going to come upon that. I mean, as I read ahead, I think we're yet to come to it. So I'll just say that, you know, here again, there was something that looked like it might have been a good idea. It flew in the face of a centralized bank, and so it, therefore it gets demonized. And I think they do that, but we'll find out as you bring us along.
Okay, and I guess you're referring to the next excerpt here, which is kind of a different tone, the Genius of America segment. Is that kind of what you were referring to there?
You know, it's just like you do with the Countess. It came in my mind, and I know that I read it somewhere here, but I haven't been able to, like, slot it in the right place, but I'll know it when
right.
I see it. So.
Yeah, that may have been one of the pieces that I didn't actually pull out, that what you're referring to, because I think this next segment takes sort of a different tone.
Oh, yeah.
And so if you didn't have any further comments on what just came to your mind just now, I'd just go right into that.
By this time, people are saying, you know, Al, shut up. So.
right.
What do you mean,
Brian?
Don't agree
with me. I won't go far as what was that?
I said, don't agree with me. Oh, yeah. All right, no, by all means, go into this, because this is kind of sharp. This is the sharpest of them all, I think, as far as criticism.
Yeah, and I think they're really shifting gears, because I think in this one, it's not pointing out what they're railing against, but I think this is showing where they're really coming from and what they want. And I think the title is a little bit telling. Now, it's still couched inside of a comic element. The title of this piece, it's really a poem in itself within this longer work. You can pull it out. It's a completely self-contained poem. It's called The Genius of America, and it's a song, and it's to the tune of piece they're alluding to, the watery god, the great Neptune lay in dalliance soft and amorous play on Amphitrite's breast, etc. So apparently they're making a reference to some kind of traditional song that the readership would have been familiar with, so they would know how to sing this piece, The Genius of America. I'm not going to attempt to set it to music here.
Good.
But the research, the little bit of looking into it, just tells me that it is it's a traditional song. It's not only a traditional song, but it's a comic song. So, again, they're couching it in this sort of satirical tone, but I think it's a different point of view from the excerpts we just looked at. So just start right into stanza one here. And did you have a page reference? Oh, yeah, that's page 26 through 28 for those who are following along here. So where spirits dwell in shadowy forms on Andes cliffs mid blackening storms, with livid lightnings curled, the awful genius of our clime in thunder raised his voice sublime and hushed the listener world. In lonely waves and wastes of earth, a mighty empire claims its birth, and heaven asserts its claims. The sails that hung in long dim, in yon dim sky proclaim the promised era nigh, which wakes a world to fame. Hail, ye first bounding ships that roam, blue tumbling billows topped with foam, that keel ne'er plowed before. Here suns perform their useless round, here rove the naked tribes embrowned, who feed on living gore. To midnight orgies, offerings dire, the human sacrifice and fire, a heavenly light succeeds. But lo, what horrors intervene, the toil severe, the carnage seen, and more than mortal deeds. Ye fathers, spread your fame afar. 'Tis yours to still the sounds of war and bid slaughter cease. The peopling hamlets wide extend, the harvest spring, the spires ascend, mid grateful songs of peace. Shall steed to steed and man to man, with discord thundering in the van, again destroy the bliss? Enough my mystic words reveal, the rest the shades of night conceal and fate's profound abyss.
You know, you're
and again, I think, as you know, that was kind of a last-minute addition to the selections here that I just stumbled over when we were first planning this sequence from this era. So I think you could probably spend multiple hours trying to explicate this bad boy. But
I tell you what,
your initial thoughts.
I was going to say, well, you're doing a fine job, but if ever I wanted to hear Vincent Price recite something, it would have been this.
I'll tell you. And I mean, would you agree that this is revelatory of where the wits are coming from in contrast to the other passages?
Let's face it, it's really discriminatory. It's racist. And an event is an absolute, and I don't think they were kidding. By all means, if you disagree, go ahead. But I don't think they were kidding in this. I mean, I think that they had this kind of extremely condescending attitude toward Native peoples along with anyone else. I mean, but because that's pretty much what it directs itself to. I mean, when it first catches you, I think, when it says, I mean, when I was reading this, I'm like, okay, you know, nice description of going across the Atlantic Ocean. And then it says, you know, going here where the sun performs its useless rounds. What is that about?
Right. I mean, it's that the sun is shining uselessly on these naked and brown tribes and feeding on living gore. I mean, that's, you know, they're really putting forth that really exaggerated stereotypes of the native peoples, who, you know, to my understanding, are the huge degree of variation to one tribe to another, and not only that, just the glimpses of forgotten history that we've run across. I mean, there may have been a much higher level of organization in some of these, you know, nations, for lack of a better word than we're told today. I mean, if you think about the little we know about the mounds and, you know, evidences of more advanced cultures, in North America, it really makes you wonder what the reality is. I mean, the fairy tale history books give you this vision of savagery. I mean, you know, the elementary school vision we get isn't as exaggerated as this with the midnight orgies and human sacrifices, but I still think that what we're getting in the mainstream world may be just as much of a cartoon version as what we're seeing here from the wits.
It almost sounds like a justification, and I believe this would in short time actually become the seeds of a genocide of Native peoples. And the justification, I mean, that's one of the things I believe we have at least touched upon privately, and that is, come on, if this is a Christian country, how are you justifying wiping out these people whose only fault was the fact that they were here first? And you know, that's something that just gets dusted under the rug, because it's like, well, when you really come down to it, they were savages. So, you know, what's the harm? And it's like, wait a second. I mean, you know, what would Jesus do? And here we are. I mean, this is the beginning of it. I tell you what, I got upbraided big time by an individual who years ago was listening to me about at least thinking Jackson was a pretty cool dude for refusing the central bank's charter. And, of course, he was able to survive an assassination when the guy's two guns jammed. I mean, wow, what's that about? So my point is, I was going on about that. Well, I got laced into, but properly, about let's remember who this guy was and how he made his bones. And that is pretty much tearing up the southeast part of the United States going after the native peoples. And I had to say, you know, it's true. We keep forgetting about this. And although that was the focus of where I was going, I have to say, okay, you know, I stand corrected to a certain degree because we do forget about this chapter that occurs pretty much right after, you know, we get our legs underneath us and even before the War of 1812. So, and I mean, and who presided over some of this in the beginning was Jefferson, you know, Mr. Clean.
Right.
So, and I mean.
And Mr. Clean from the Democratic Republican side of the fence supposedly Jedediah Morse was railing against. So.
Also, one other thing, you can read an Avalon, and maybe I will look for this link. I'll do it. I'll throw it in there for folks to take a look at. Avalon, are you familiar with that site that has an awful lot of documents like the treaties of Paris and such?
No, but it sounds like something I'm definitely going to want to check out.
Yeah, you definitely bookmark this because it's really, I mean, it's got the real deal. I mean, all the treaties that were involved with the United States in the early going. But one of them is like a letter from Jefferson to the Cherokee Nation. I believe it's just the Cherokee. But, I mean, it was so patronizing. I was frosted. It's like, you know, Thomas Jefferson had spoke out of both sides of his neck. And in this case, what he's calling these people, I am your father and you are my little children. And I'm like, I can just see like a couple of heads of the tribes, you know, who are like maybe 70 years old and have been here for that long a time and, you know, remember back to their grandfather. And they must look at each other going, what is this clown talking about, you know? Oh, my goodness. I mean, it was, I mean, read it and tell me if you don't get a little bit, I mean, it was like 10 times worse than what you've just read now. But again, this embraces a period of time that we choose to forget. So, and let me just ask you, JQ, you don't think that this is hyperbole, do you? Or do you? I don't know.
I don't think so.
No.
I mean, if you look at how the longer work shifts gears into this, and I don't think they were kidding, as you said earlier. And I think, you know, you point to Jefferson as another example of that kind of mindset that these native peoples were, you know, somehow subhuman or something. Yeah. It's there, I think. And the fact that, you know, the editor who introduced the book said that the public took a lot of this with a great deal of credulity, so they might have bought right into this concept of the human sacrifice in the midnight orgies, and I don't think that this is something that would have been responded to with people being horrified and writing letters to the editor of the New Haven Times or whatever it was. How can you publish this stuff? I think people probably, it really reveals what the mindset of a lot of the people at the time were.
But you included it, and even if it was an afterthought, I think there's a reason why you were compelled to include that, and I'm glad you did, because again, it's a little bit more evidence for those who want to come to their own opinions about this kind of attitude in literature. And let's remember, I mean, this is what we're talking about, and that is visions of global empire, and you've got to believe that with us it started right there.
Absolutely. And you know, you really can't excuse people of this mindset too much, because after all, there already were active abolitionists by this time. So it's not as if it was a universal part of the culture to have this very inhuman kind of attitude towards other races, if you will.
No problem. I would say, though, they probably had enough impetus to get what they wanted done, and that was behind some kind of military incursion. And as it said even in the poem, to extend the front, well, it didn't say extend the frontier, but obviously it said what? Ye fathers, spread your fame afar, And then it goes on and says the peopling hamlets wide extend. Well, what does that mean? I mean, obviously they want to go beyond the 13 states to the western frontier, which would be at that time, right? I mean, western Virginia, Ohio, western Pennsylvania even to a certain degree.
Right.
So I think that – I guess what I'm saying is I think that we're providing what they would consider a sound justification for going after the Aboriginal races.
Yeah, and, you know, I love how they implicitly work in a religious reference at the end. I mean, right after that passage you just alluded to, the hamlets wide extend, then it says the harvest spring, the spires ascend. So we're talking about we're populating this this savage land with you know, bucolic farms and church spires.
Churches, yes.
I mean, really? I mean, yeah, that's a real Christian attitude that they're promulgating in the body of this poem here, and then they have to work that religious allusion into there.
Yeah, real quickly, and I want to let you know, we're a little bit more than three quarters of the way through, so we probably won't get to Philip Freneau and his writing, because we have another piece to go through, and I believe is The Departure. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, is the what now?
Are we going, just, I want to address something here, but our next work we're going to cover is called The Departure. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah, that was Philip Freneau's first work, and it's a rather lengthy one as well.
All right, well, I'll leave it up to you as to how you want to approach what we would consider almost like a third part to this series. And we've been talking about Freneau, and again, it's something that really it's great to get into, and maybe this is the time to do it. But lastly, one thing, and this has always struck me, as you just said about, you know, let's go slaughter the people and then put up churches. What struck me was D. Brown's book, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, when they had the massacre of the Sioux in around the 1890, or somewhere around there. They were going to round them up and bring them to Nebraska, something like that. And so they had the shootout in the winter right around Christmas. And obviously this strikes everybody deeply, and that is the visual of the soldiers bringing in the dead Sioux in a church in which there was strung across the front of the church. It said, peace on earth, goodwill toward men.
So, yeah.
I mean, that's a killer.
Some heavy, heavy irony there, certainly. And I mean, as you've said, that whole epoch is really something that we receive most of us receive a real dearth of detail about today. I mean, the level of carnage that took place on both sides, granted, but I don't think we're told a whole lot of truth about who these people really were and what their way of life and cultures were like. And it was just this crass, megalomaniacal sense of superiority of the Europeans. I mean, just comes blasting through when you see a passage like that. And again, I don't think you can excuse it just as the result of the times. There's other loaded phrases in that passage that you could look at. I mean, I think it's interesting that the reference to the empire moving in from eastern climes and the reference to the sun. I mean, I think there's things you could do with that if there to wonder if they're somehow hearkening back to any kind of eastern mystery religion imagery or anything like that. And, you know, the reference to human sacrifices is certainly something that on the face of it refers to the native peoples and the practices that stereotypically were associated with them. But here, the human sacrifice in fire, a heavenly light succeeds. So you almost wonder whether that's not an image of almost like a ritual sacrifice that would usher in this kind of a new age of empire when the sun would shine upon this new world that's being set up and this glorious new world being set up by the more enlightened, quote-unquote, minds of the Europeans.
this will conclude the Anarchiad, and then we're going to go over into Philip Freneau. And I don't want this poem to be forgotten as later on as you get into Freneau's work. But you've raised something that I had not thought about, and you've by doing that, you've loosed a terrible beast. So now, well, it's just provocative that you, what you mentioned. And that are we looking at here the same old mixture of secret societal thought? And since, the, let's face it, what we're dealing with was here, and the premise for your series is that, you know, emerging visions of global power. We're talking about, in short shorthand, the New World Order. And are these people who are considering themselves probably some kind of harbinger, are making a case, and also with a wink and a nod about talking about, as you had said, Eastern mysticism or what refers back to Europe and what was going on there, whether it was Illuminati or whatever, and then in a way taking those motives and those goals and wrapping them inside the church because you can get it across better. What are your thoughts? Is that where you were going with that? I mean,
yeah, I couldn't put it better. I think that's well phrased. And you made a reference to this kind of intermixing of these elements, and I think we're going to see that when we get into Freneau as someone who is supposedly on the, and that's something I'm going to explore in some depth when we get into Freneau, but this is supposedly somebody who was on the other side of the fence, but he didn't really, it appears that he didn't really expressly get on the quote unquote other side of the fence until the new regime was put in place. But you're going to see some of these same elements working themselves in on both sides. And what that tells me, these supposed secret society traditions, Eastern mysticism, that kind of imagery. So what that tells me is that the whole picture is murky, and we can't make a simplistic a dividing line, and we can't necessarily look for even, you know, black hats and white hats here. I think we're going to see that Freneau is not, even though he's supposedly opposed to this side of the fence that we're seeing with the wits, I wouldn't characterize him as one of the good guys. And maybe the message is that when you look at these elite circles, you're possibly not going to, you shouldn't expect, or it's not realistic to expect to find any good guys.
No, and this bespeaks of the hypocrisy that Christianity is seen as even to this day. And I can understand why many folks would be turned off by it. But again, as you understand, there's a difference between, quote, religion and what we would call a relationship with Jesus Christ. But you can see how institutionalized religion has been extremely, well, if it hasn't been abused, it's allowed itself to be lent to doing some very nefarious and, you know, murderous things. And the other thing is, you take a look at these people, and they weren't just like you and me. You have these characters popping up, whether it's from Yale, or in the case of Freneau and Aaron Burr and others, Princeton. To this very day, it's just like it was then. They ain't like us. So,
yeah. As Hemingway said, the rich are different from us, or was it Fitzgerald? Yes, they are. I think it was Fitzgerald said the rich are different from us, and Hemingway said, yes, they have much more money.
Absolutely. And then and they're throwing Gertrude in there, too. You are all a lost generation. So.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, we're coming up on about five more minutes, so if I don't know if you want to broach where we're going or...
Yeah, I mean, again, as you've indicated, we're going to go into Philip Freneau, and he's a loaded subject in himself. Perhaps we should leave that to the next segment and maybe try to splice onto that some of the next period we would be looking at in terms of later in the 19th century, around the middle of the 18th century through, you know, after the Civil War period, because, again, it might make more sense to really give a solid introduction to Freneau at the beginning of the next segment. I don't know what your feeling is about that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I had said it before. You know, if for nothing else, and it's certainly not the case, but if for nothing else, you only came up with Freneau, this would all been worthwhile. because it reminds me of personages throughout history who, as I had said before, kind of act as a composite figure that we're used to seeing as in devices such as Little Big Man. What's the one with Forrest Gump? I think you had mentioned
right.
that. And also Ragtime, where you have a character that's, you know, that's seeing everything that's happening at the time. It makes for a very good storytelling device. But here you have a person that really was like that, and you cannot find him in a history book. And maybe he doesn't warrant that. But certainly, this gives you an idea of how many individuals who have great stories about them that we'll never, ever know. I mean, they've just passed by. And unless people like you pull something like this out, which is worthwhile, we're never going to know about some of the really interesting characters who were part of this whole pastiche. And, well, you know, it's anonymous. So, you know, good for you on that count.
Well, I appreciate that, Alan. And I think you're right. I mean, I think that's one of the things I've discovered in this kind of unexpected little exercise here is that looking at literature and poetry helps you to find things that might not have made it into the history books. And again, I had, you know, had some limited exposure to Philip Freneau. There's a couple of pieces of his that have made it into Norton anthologies and things like that. So, and you know, like an undergraduate survey course of American literature of the time period, you're going to run across him to a limited extent. But yeah, clearly, there's a lot more to his story than most of us ever find out.
And I'll confess to having a hole in that particular genre because I don't know why it was just my likes and dislikes, but the early part of American literature, and I have to confess, even when I taught it,
right,
I got through this thing real quick.
You know? Yeah. And, well, it's kind of like the old joke, haughty literary scholar from the UK at one time was quoted as saying, American literature? Well, you can read it in an evening.
There you go. And the British are different, too. Oh.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, we've come to the end, and I thank you for this, but I also, you know, I'm not a shameless plugger, but where we're headed with Philip Freneau is really very interesting. And also, we all have a homework assignment. Find out the Countess's name and the book she wrote before it drives me nuts.
Oh, absolutely.
All right,
yeah, I would greatly appreciate that because I'd love to be able to get my hands on that book again.
And I tell you, I have faith in the people who listen. They'll make short work of this, I promise you. So, all right, JQ, thanks
great.
Very much for part two. And we'll look forward to part three when we're talking about Philip Freneau and his circle.